It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We get up to speed on the latest developments in state politics with help from the nonprofit newsroom Wisconsin Watch. And you can be part of this discussion at any point. Share what you're paying attention to at the Capitol. Call in with a question or comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jack Kelly is a State House reporter at Wisconsin Watch, formerly on this beat at the Capitol Times. Jack, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Overriding vetoes. Governor Tony Evers issues 10 vetoes this month, and you report this action places Democratic lawmakers on a veto watch. Republicans are short of a supermajority in the assembly. Why do Democrats feel they need to be on alert?
Right. So, it would be some procedural tactics to override a veto from Republicans here. But if you actually take a look at the Wisconsin Constitution, it mandates that to override a veto, you need 2/3 support from present members, not all members. Mm. So if just 3 Democratic lawmakers were missing in the assembly, of course, Republicans already have a supermajority in the Senate. If just 3 Democratic members were missing in the assembly, Republicans could call a snap veto override vote and try to override one of Evers' vetoes, which would be very unusual for decades now. I think it's been something like 38 years since a veto has been successfully overridden in Wisconsin. So Democrats are on alert for sure. They're spending a lot more time in Madison than they are used to this time of year.
Snap veto vote. How quickly could a vote happen?
Well, you know, it's a little bit unclear. Obviously, there are something to be said about having to notice sessions. Mm-hmm. But that's why we're seeing something that lawmakers use these session days called skeletal sessions, which basically involve a few members that they use to help keep a schedule. And all Democrats have been coming to Madison or will be coming to Madison for upcoming scheduled skeletal session days. Just to try to avoid being caught off guard on one of these days that usually is just help used to keep the usual floor schedule, but they want to avoid an override vote that they're not prepared for.
What is Minority Leader Greta Neubauer saying about this and how they're navigating this as Democratic leader?
Yeah. Representative Neubauer has made clear that this is a top priority for her members. She has said over and over again that protecting the governor's veto power is something that her caucus is taking very seriously and is willing to sacrifice for. I mean, she was saying recently how members are prepared to, you know, sacrifice time in their districts and with their families and do whatever it takes to make sure that they're present on the days they need to be so that they can protect the veto powers from the governor, which obviously is probably one of his most powerful, if not his most powerful tool.
I wonder if Democrats are in Madison for all session dates, if votes pop up, could it mean more productivity for their caucus?
You know, that's a great question. You would probably have to ask them that. though, you know, we did see some bipartisan deal making happen during the budget cycle earlier this summer. Maybe they'll, you know, would be able to work some deals out with their Republican colleagues if they were spending more time together. But that remains to be seen. I think you'd have to ask them.
Jack Kelly with us as we talk state politics, State House reporter at Wisconsin Watch. You can join in with your questions and what you are keeping an eye on in state politics. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. On Wednesday, the Wisconsin Elections Commission voted to avoid giving Administrator Megan Wolf direction on whether to appear at a Senate hearing on her future with the agency. Where does this leave Wolf?
Well, if you ask her, she says that it leaves her in a, quote, untenable position. This is very unusual and kind of uncharted waters. Obviously, Administrator Wolf's term expired, but because of a state Supreme Court ruling involving a lawsuit between the Attorney General and a guy named Fred Prain, who was a former chairman of the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board, that found that the expiration of a term does not create a vacancy. Democratic members on the Wisconsin Elections Commission are convinced that there is no vacancy, there is no renomination, and that Megan Wolf can just stay in the job indefinitely. So she is definitely working in uncharted waters here. And I know a lot of people are paying attention to see if she will appear before the Senate committee later this month.
The Bipartisan Elections Commission deadlocked 3-3 along party lines on a vote to reappoint Wolf. So with Democrats abstaining in, from that vote, what did that cause? What does that mean?
Yeah, so just to clarify, Republican members of the commission, the three of them voted in favor of renominating her. The three Democratic commissioners abstained, which basically put them in this position where to do pretty much anything with the Elections Commission, you need four votes. That's by design. Three Democrats, three Republicans, you need at least four votes. You have bipartisan agreement in some capacity to advance anything, a rule change, whatever it might be. They deadlocked, which means that she wasn't renominated, which I think if you ask the Democratic commissioners would mean that, you know, what the Senate Republicans are trying to do now is, you know, kind of running afoul of the law. Now, if you ask Senate Republicans, I think they would tell you something different. This is pretty much all but certain to end up in the courts and have the courts determine what happens next.
So, Elections Commissioner Ann Jacobs spoke up about this, says the Senate hearing with Wolf would be illegitimate and based on a false reading of the law. How are Democrats and Republicans viewing the law differently?
Yeah, so this goes back to the idea about whether Megan Wolf was renominated or not. The Democrats on the Election Commission are reading this case and this precedent from the state Supreme Court that since her term expired, but there has not been someone appointed to replace her, there's no vacancy in her role. Therefore, she continues to be administrator despite her term having expired. Republicans say that they voted, and because it didn't get to four votes, but because of the Democrats abstained, that 3-0 vote was enough to renominate her. So they're going to go through the process of having hearings and then, you know, put it up for a vote. Like I said, probably going to land in the courts because, you know, there are multiple interpretations of the law, and that is what the courts are here to do, is to interpret the law.
What could this disagreement, this friction mean ahead of the 2024 election?
Right. Well, as I'm sure you're well aware, Wisconsin has not had, you know, from a PR perspective, the easiest time with running elections in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election. This could create some uncertainty. Megan Wolf is widely respected as an election administrator. People think very highly of her, both here in the state and nationally. And losing your top nonpartisan election official, like headed into the 2024 presidential election cycle, could be a little bit rocky. I know some municipal clerks have expressed concerns about this. Obviously, Megan's chief job is to implement the policies put in place by the bipartisan elections commissioners and to be a resource for your local and county clerks, who are the people that really administer elections in Wisconsin. They're the front line. They handle, you know, absentee balloting and everything else. So it could definitely create some uncertainty for folks as we head into what is likely going to be another razor-thin election in 2024 in the presidential race here in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Watch State House reporter Jack Kelly, our guide to what is transpiring in state politics, how it affects life here in Wisconsin. You can join the conversation, call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The nonprofit newsroom Wisconsin Watch gets us up to speed on issues in state politics, and there's room for your thoughts. call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jack Kelly is State House reporter at Wisconsin Watch. Jack, last week, former director of Wisconsin's court system, Randy Koshnick, filed complaints against his replacement and the justices who voted to remove him. What does Koshnick say in his complaints?
Yeah, the crux of the complaint is that his replacement, who is a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, is not able to serve in the role as director of state courts because she is still a judge. And he might have a case if you read the law, depending on how it works out. But this all stems from kind of the abrupt firing of Koshnick by the now liberal majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which happened just, a day after now Justice Janet Protasiewicz was sworn in earlier this month.
And Koshnick said on our show a week ago that this attempt by the four liberal justices is breathtaking, unprecedented. And Koshnick says, thinks it creates a constitutional crisis in Wisconsin. What rises to that level here?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not sure what rises to that level. I think it does certainly reflect some of the animosity on the court these days. Obviously, any number of very contentious decisions could come before the court. Probably chief among them, at least in the immediate term, would be a reconsideration of the state legislative maps and also a challenge to Wisconsin's, 19th century abortion ban. So, the court has always been a source of great power, obviously, as the third branch of government. And I think now, more so than ever, we're going to see its influence over the state of Wisconsin.
What if the Judicial Commission believes there is an ethics violation through Koshnick's complaints?
That is an excellent question. That I do not have the answer to right off the top of my head, and I would have to look into it.
That's okay. We'll keep watch on that. Turning more deeply to the Supreme Court, you mentioned the new justice, Janet Protasiewicz, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says that she should recuse herself from lawsuits challenging the state's election maps. And Voss is warning that lawmakers could impeach her. What would lawmakers need to do to impeach Justice Protasiewicz?
Yeah, so that is another great question. And my colleague at Wisconsin Watch, Matt DeFore, wrote a really interesting story about this. So, with impeachment, there's effectively kind of two ways to remove a judge. You have impeachment, which you can kind of think of as related to crimes. And then you have this mechanism called address, which involves a two-thirds majority vote in the assembly, not just a simple majority's vote, and is related to potential ethics violations or, violations of the judicial code.
Mm-hmm.
So this would probably fall more under that. He's making the case that she has violated the judicial code because she campaigned on these things and has, air quotes, prejudged cases. But to do that, they would run into kind of the same situation as they would to override a veto, where they're just a few members short of being able to do it. Now, who knows what would happen when you got to the state Senate, right? Obviously, trying to remove an official like this is a two-step process. The assembly votes, and then there would be, the second step of it in the state Senate. And if all 22 Republicans would be on board there, trying to remove a judge is very uncommon. It hasn't happened for a very long time. And so I think we'll have to wait and see. But I think this would be a high bar to meet.
Let's bring on a call now. Nick is joining us from Madison. Nick, hi. What is on your mind?
Hi. I'm curious as to where Wisconsin is with the co-conspirators and the fake elector scheme. It seems Michigan has already taken steps, and this is involved in the Georgia case, and I'm hearing Arizona. What is the what is Josh Call thinking? Is what is stopping him, and what is your thought on this? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you,
Nick. Thank you. What can you offer us there, Jack, in terms of Wisconsin's fake electors and what could be the legal consequences?
Sure. I knew we were going to get this question. The Attorney General has been very tight-lipped about this. I think his staff is now shopping this line around of we cannot confirm or deny the existence of an investigation. Something that I will say is that each state has different laws. What electors are being charged, these fake electors are being charged for in Michigan, might be difficult to do in Wisconsin, depending on the statutes. Again, I'm not an attorney and I'm certainly not a prosecutor. But I think that, a lot of people are eager to hear about this. What I would say is it might happen. It might not. There's no way to know. And we're probably not going to go know until the day that anything, any sort of charges would be announced. So, there's not much to say because the attorney general himself won't say much about this beyond that, he can't confirm or deny an investigation and that he's been, relying on federal partners. So, there's not a lot of new information, honestly, about what's going on here in Wisconsin.
Jack Kelly with us, State House reporter at Wisconsin Watch, as we work through developments in state politics and take your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jack, Wisconsin on the stage this week, the first Republican presidential primary debate set for Wednesday at Pfizer Forum in Milwaukee. There's talk of between 4,000 and 6,000 people expected to be in the lower part of the arena. What does it mean to have the first debate here in Wisconsin?
I mean, I think it shows how serious the RNC is taking Wisconsin. Obviously, Wisconsin is one of a handful of swing states. It is probably the swingiest state if you just look at a data from a data perspective. But I mean, I think it shows that Republicans want their presence to be felt here in Wisconsin. Obviously, some people are talking about this as a dry run for the convention next year. Now, that's a totally different scale because there will be tens of thousands of people here over a period of several days. But I mean, I think it is significant for sure. Now, I'm most interested to see who actually makes it onto the stage. Obviously, the former President Trump said he won't be here. So we'll see if anybody can, seize the moment and kind of break out because without him being here, and we'll see if some of these other candidates, who have claimed to make the stage, Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, jumps out at me, to see if he's actually going to be there, this week or if it's all talk.
It's interesting, too, as you point out, the New York Times reported Friday that former President Trump plans to skip the debate to do an interview with the ex-Fox host, Tucker Carlson. Meanwhile, Fox sponsoring this debate. What are the dynamics there?
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times has done great reporting on this, other places as well, that this just shows that the former president, as always, wants to command attention and will continue to try to do so. Obviously, this counter programming with this interview with Tucker Carlson that he plans to post on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. I think the New York Times has reported that they've actually already recorded the interview. So this is literally just a programming note at this point that they're holding on to it until 7 p.m. or a decision until holding it on until the debate on this week. So, I guess we'll see. But I think if you're the former president, why come to the debate and allow your challengers to attack you when you have such a large lead in many of these national polls, and probably more critically, in many of these early voting polls? So in early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, et cetera.
Let's land on President Biden traveling to Milwaukee ahead of the Republican presidential primary debate to promote his economic agenda last week. What issues do you see as top of mind for the GOP debate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be many similar things. Obviously, there's a fight between the White House and the Republicans about what the meaning of Bidenomics is. Obviously, economic issues are important to everyone. They're often ranked very highly among voters. Now, I think was there maybe a bit of an overemphasis on them from Republicans in 2022? I think that, in a year that was supposed to be an air quotes red wave, that Democrats actually did fairly competitively, showed that maybe voters cared more about other things like abortion access. So I think, some of what we see from the Republicans in Milwaukee will try to be counter to the story that Biden and the White House is are trying to tell. But, I guess we'll see. Everybody's going to have a different game plan for the debate among the candidates. And so I guess we'll see what avenues they all pursue to try to leave their mark on Milwaukee before they get out of town.
Jack, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jack Kelly is State House reporter at Wisconsin Watch as we touch down on state politics each week. And you can, if you missed any part of our conversation, you can stream it, download a recording later today at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Governor Tony Evers' administration says the new two-year budget provides an additional $3.4 million to reimburse counties for costs associated with providing services to crime victims and witnesses. We explore the work of the Justice Department's Office of Crime Victim Services that provides financial help and advocates for policies that enhance victims' rights and services. Call in with a question or comment along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Shira Phelps is executive director of the Office of Crime Victim Services, assuming the position in March. Shira, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you started the job in March, what are your biggest priorities to improve services for crime victims?
Well, I see our role really as making sure that survivors and victims' voices and experiences are respected and central to all the work that we do in our office, and also the work that the criminal justice system does, that the Wisconsin Department of Justice does, sort of bringing the human element into the criminal justice process.
What does it mean to bring the human element? How do you give voice to survivors? What would be an example?
Well, I think number one is to listen to survivors. So one of the things that we're working on right now in our office is to develop a survivor advisory committee that will be a group of survivors of all sorts of different types of crime who can really help guide and advise the work that we do in the Office of Crime Victim Services, as well as the work that's being done at the Department of Justice.
You told the State Journal that what draws you to this work is the women you work with. And you say you've never met such strong, brave, remarkable people. But you also say the systems have failed them. What are the biggest issues?
Well, I have had the honor of working with survivors of human trafficking, sexual assault, domestic violence, a number of different gender-based crimes in my time working in victim services. And yes, the survivors are the most courageous and really outstanding folks I've ever had the honor to work with. I also have the honor of working with now in OCVS with a team of incredibly dedicated and brilliant victim service providers who work every day to try to sort of problem solve all of the gaps that our many systems have in serving victims of crime. As we work with survivors and we hear, not only the tragedy and the trauma that they've experienced in surviving or being a victim of crime, but just getting basic needs met in their lives. It's the criminal justice system sees survivors, at the one of the worst times in their life, and they are, participating in the criminal justice system. And after an investigation or a prosecution is over, the victim's life continues, and the trauma that they've endured continues. And so we really need to make sure that we as communities and systems are set up to continue to provide support and healing for survivors and the trauma that they've experienced.
Part of that support comes from the Victim Compensation Fund, your office overseeing a fund that helps pay survivors for expenses that result from a crime. And from October 2021 to September 2022, the fund paid $3.9 million to more than 1,000 survivors. What are the challenges to reimbursing survivors?
Oh, well, right now it's the volume, which is quite large. There are a lot of folks that are really in need of compensation of, lost wages due to being a victim of a crime. In some cases, funeral expenses for a loved one who is a victim of a crime. And just being able to process, those claims and make sure that the victims are getting what they need within the statute that provides the compensation.
And who or what funds this Victim Compensation Fund? Where does it receive those dollars?
Sure. So it's a federal pool of money, and it is not through tax dollars. It's through federal fines and forfeitures, and so it is a fund, the Victims of Crime Act fund, or sort of pool of money, provides victim compensation for every state and territory in the nation, on sort of like a formula basis.
When you look at the fund, and the number of applications, is the funding adequate for Wisconsin?
Well, I would say, there. It's hard to put a dollar amount on what victims and survivors need after being a victim of a crime and after the trauma that they have endured. And it's about the dollar, there is a dollar amount, and it's also just about the capacity of our team to meet the need of the many, many hundreds and hundreds of victims that are filing claims to receive this compensation.
Are there survivors who tend to be denied compensation as you look at your numbers and statistics on this fund?
Honestly, I don't know the numbers. We have an incredible crime victim compensation team in our office, and if they are denied, it is not, it's due to the statutory elements that we are, required to uphold. But not to answer the question, but I really don't know what the numbers
Sure.
are, and I don't believe they're very high.
Talking with Shira Phelps, who leads the state's Office of Crime Victim Services, as we look more deeply at the role, you can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Shira, people who commit crimes are often victims of crimes themselves. How does the office address the overlap between offender and crime victim?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that there is such a need for ongoing support and healing for crime victims, especially children who have experienced such trauma and such, in many cases, violence. And then once, the system has done its work around investigation or prosecution or whatever piece the system is playing, that person's life moves on, and there's continued support and healing that is needed, and resources are needed for those ongoing supports. And so, an offender or someone who has committed a crime and harmed someone else, they may have been a victim of a crime, and that might help explain why they have done what they've done, but they've still caused harm. And so we still need to focus on the harm that was done and the person that was harmed. When you take a step back and you look at the cycle of that, it's really heartbreaking and a very clear call for the resources that are needed to really help heal and support crime victims.
And when you look at the cycle and what is justice, from your perspective, what are your thoughts on harsher penalties for people who commit crimes?
Well, I don't know if penalties are really what we should be focusing on. Obviously, for public safety, we need to be thinking about consequences for actions. But we really, I believe, need to be focusing more of our efforts and resources on how do we get people the things that they need and the healing that they need so that they don't either feel that they need to commit crimes to meet their basic needs, or that they have been hurt before and they are still dealing with their trauma and therefore taking that out on other people and causing harm. I think penalties, there's a place for that, of course. But I really think that our entire system needs to be focused more on how do we help folks heal and how do we help give communities and families support so that that cycle doesn't continue.
Looking at your office's new budget over the next 2 years, the new state budget provides an additional $3.4 million to reimburse counties for those costs associated with providing services to crime victims and witnesses. Is that adequate funding?
It is better than nothing. As I said before, I don't know when we get to adequate funding, honestly. I think it's wonderful that that folks were given and victim witness offices were given additional funds because they are so desperately needed. So I don't want to belittle that. Absolutely phenomenal. And I don't think we get to a point where we say, oh, we have enough. We're meeting all of the needs of victims of crime, and we can move on, unfortunately.
Sheriff Phelps with us leads the Office of Crime Victim Services inside the State Justice Department as we discuss the needs of crime victims and survivors and funding for programs in the new 2-year state budget. Call in with a question, share comments along the way, 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine programs within the state's Office of Crime Victim Services and aspects of the state's new 2-year spending plan that could assist crime victims in pursuit of justice. The office helps survivors with their rights and access to services. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Shira Phelps is here, Executive Director of the Office of Crime Victim Services. Shira, you recently answered questions from survivors of abuse by clergy in Wisconsin through the organization AWAKE. What were your takeaways from those questions?
Well, I was happy to be interviewed, and I think it gave an opportunity to just shine another light on the clergy and faith leader abuse initiative. This initiative has been we're on 2 years now out of DOJ, and the level of support and all of that we're able to give victims is good, and we need to be doing more in for longer. You know, I think it reminded me, being relatively new to this role, it reminded me of the importance of this initiative and that, you know, we have folks calling in who are in their 80s and who have never spoken of the abuse that they suffered, by, you know, members of the clergy. And just to have an opportunity and a place to be able to do that, to say it out loud, have someone say, "I'm so sorry that that happened, and I believe you," has offered, you know, peace and comfort to so many. And there's still a lot of work to be done. And so it was a good, my takeaways were, we're doing really great work, and there's still so much left to be done.
Part of that upcoming work, perhaps the State Department of Justice filing a motion to seize sealed records from the Milwaukee branch of the Catholic Church, the sealed records related to the $21 million settlement between the Archdiocese and hundreds of sexual abuse survivors. The department says the documents could help hold abusers accountable, and the church says, look, releasing the documents would violate trust. What is your take on that conflict?
Well, I think it is interesting to hear that from the church. So these are folks that have filed claims of abuse against the church, and all of these claims, you know, went to the church. They have seen them. What the DOJ is asking for is to be able to see these documents and only to be able to use any information in cases where a survivor has contacted DOJ and has given permission for us to move forward, to investigate, to you know, to either try and get the clergy on the credibly accused, the church's credibly accused list, or to see if, you know, the statute of limitations is still in place if there's more that can be done in the criminal justice system. What we're asking for would not make any of these claims public, and I think it's a misrepresentation to say that they would.
If DOJ, Department of Justice, provides resources to survivors who are making reports to the clergy and faith leader abuse hotline and calling, what type of support is there? What are those resources like?
There are a number of, you know, really caring and wonderful supports for child sexual assault survivors, adult sexual assault survivors, some that focus on those who are harmed by clergy specifically, and some are more general. And, you know, we have a victim services specialist in our office who is incredible. And it is her full-time job is to take these reports for the Clergy and Faith Leader Abuse Initiative and to talk to folks and either refer them on for counseling or supportive services, or just to sort of answer questions about where their case is and where they are in the process.
Transparency in this process, you know, with this investigation through the Department of Justice, how important is that transparency in terms of what DOJ is trying to do?
Well, I always think transparency is important. You know, when you're dealing with ongoing cases and investigations, criminal investigations, it's transparency takes on a different word, right? There's a lot of stuff that you can't talk about. But I do think it's important for the overall initiative to be very transparent about what we are able to do, what we aren't able to do, what, you know, sort of where we are in the process. As I said, it's been 2 years, and we've had I think 280 reports so far, and that's not an exact number. That's a it's an estimation. And you know, and as I said, we, you know, we still have a ways to go, and we as we receive these reports and we follow up on every single one of them, you know, we're also putting together a report that will be public, and will be published, that talks about, you know, not just the reports but the responses from the different faith communities, and hopefully we will be as transparent as possible.
Sheriff Phelps leads the state's Office of Crime Victim Services within the State Department of Justice. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Shira, you most recently worked for the Federal Office of Victims of Crime in addressing missing and murdered Indigenous people and human trafficking. How can you apply what you learned on a national scale to your work in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's, again, I think the mission or sort of what we are striving to do in OCVS, bringing that human piece into the criminal justice system, is something I learned in the 20 years of, victim services, and also working with different communities across the country, and more specifically, tribes across the country, and how important and critical it is to involve communities and families in the work, and that survivors don't, exist in a vacuum. They are in our communities, they are in our families, and how do we work together to support survivors, and how do we think about providing victim services for communities that are and have been historically marginalized, and who really have a distrust for the criminal justice system, which is real. And so then how do we, as DOJ, right, victim services, how do we start to rebuild that trust and provide as much healing and resources that we can in a way that is culturally respectful and acknowledging, some of the harm that we have caused, the bigger we of the system, and also just looking at and listening to communities tell us what they need and provide services in that way.
In our last moments together, is Wisconsin making progress to end human trafficking?
I believe so. I think there are a lot of really incredible people working really hard and working together on multidisciplinary teams. DOJ has the Wisconsin Anti-Human Trafficking Task Force that is working law enforcement and victim services together to address this issue.
Shira, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shira Phelps is Executive Director of the Office of Crime Victim Services. And you can hear this and other types of conversations over on our program page. Go to WPR.org/mornings. And you can also follow up for future ideas. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.